Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
U.S. companies announced 257,000 job cuts in the first quarter of this year. The new jobs numbers estimate for February is due tomorrow. The consensus is to expect 214,000 jobs were created. What are the ramifications for the economy and central bank policy from these numbers?
Well, it's a tricky one because the way that the numbers are estimated, the U.S. Establishment Survey basically asks 119,000 businesses and government agencies to estimate how many jobs they added in the period in question. And the problem is that in that particular survey, the response rate has fallen to 40%. And before the pandemic, it was, 65%. So first of all, we've got a very shrinking pool of people giving us the data now in advance, and it has tended to overshoot significantly. As a matter of fact, the revisions since January 2023, the retrospective revisions have been to reduce that number that was reported initially by almost 500,000 jobs. So we've got this weird scenario where you've got this one number that comes out every month, and the estimate is pretty robust or strong, looks pretty good. And then the household survey, which is this other part of it where they ask 60,000 households to try to tell us if they're employed, that survey number has been coming in much weaker. So the expected rise or the year-over-year change in the household survey employment number is less than 0.5%, while the year-over-year change in this non-farm payrolls number is just under 2%. So we've got this big dichotomy. Both of these things can't be correct. They're supposed to be measuring essentially the same thing, but they're giving these vastly different information. The problem is, of course, that financial markets trade on these headline numbers, and then, after the fact, it's often missed or not broadcast in the mainstream media, the big revisions, or people miss the significance of it. So you get this kind of a glowing picture, which isn't necessarily reflective of reality. At the same time, they're expecting the U3 unemployment rate, so this is the broad U.S. unemployment rate, to actually go down in tomorrow's numbers to 3.8%. from 3.9%. Jerome Powell, in his latest press conference, was talking about the fact that the U.S. Fed is now looking at a trigger point of 4% unemployment for being sufficient to get them going on their rate cutting cycle. So everybody's trying to, guess when the U.S. Fed is going to start this great rate cutting cycle. And it's now been over 2 years since they started tightening rates. They haven't tightened again. They stopped tightening in July, but they've been on this pause. And the catalyst, because don't forget they have this dual mandate, Jim, it's not just inflation that they want to have between the 1% and 3% range, but they also have to keep this stability in the employment rate piece, of which they've recently defined as 4% unemployment. So as soon as they tick up to 4% unemployment, Powell has intimated they can start cutting interest rates. So everyone's sort of wanting that to happen, but at the same time, you know, once the unemployment starts to move up, and the unemployment rate has been moving higher, actually, in Canada, it's up significantly, about almost 1% from where it bottomed in this cycle, and the U.S. Rate has been rising as well. And the bad news is that it always increases. Once it starts to rise, it accelerates during economic downturns or recessions and typically rises all the way through into the recovery phase. So you've got this push and pull of wanting to have rate cuts because people are having such trouble with, you know, refinancing costs and the cost of carry and the high debt levels. Interest expense ratios are at all-time highs. So all that means they want this rate cut, but the U.S. Fed is saying not until they see unemployment tick up. So if we get this lower number tomorrow where, you know, or this overestimation tomorrow where the headline survey looks strong again and the consensus numbers, you know, the job growth comes in as expected and the unemployment rate ticks down, then arguably that could put off the idea or the hope of rate cuts even further past the June deadline, which many people have been kind of focused on, and say perhaps that you won't see any for later than that. So that doesn't mean if they don't start any near-term cuts, that doesn't suggest any short-term alleviation of the interest rate pressure, which is currently quite significant throughout the economy. And at the same time, you've got the Bank of Canada. You know, we have a weaker job scenario in this country. We've had it masked by a lot of the immigration that's, you know, really glossed over a lot of the numbers that would otherwise be apparent. But basically, our economy, we know, is much weaker than the U.S. economy. We know that we have these shorter mortgage terms, and we know that there's, a lot of them coming up for renewal this year, next year, and that the average increase is about 25% in terms of interest costs. So everyone is really, you know, hoping and begging for some rate relief. At the same time, so the Canadian Bank of Canada normally waits for the U.S. Fed or tries to go in sync so that our currencies are kept in a decent relative strength scenario. But, you know, everyone is now saying that the Bank of Canada needs to cut as well, and they better get on with it because things are getting worse here. So you've got a kind of a different scenario in the U.S. where the economic data is looking stronger, but the chances of, you know, it's which outcome do you want tomorrow? Do you want consensus job growth, which is probably overstated but won't be revised down for some time, because that means the U.S. Fed is probably going to stay on hold longer, and that means the Bank of Canada is going to have this very difficult choice of whether they are going to cut early, go before the Fed, weaken our currency further. The Canadian dollar's already been weakening. And that's not going to help our inflationary issues here. They are also concerned about, you know, this shelter inflation, which has been so stubbornly high and continues to be insanely unaffordable. At the same time, oil prices, Jim, have come up 25% since the fourth quarter of 23. And that tends to filter through and be a problem for households and businesses and, you know, make inflationary pressures on the things that matter that much more acute. So we're really in a rock and a hard place here. It's you know, on the one hand, the market's looking for cuts. On the other hand, there's factors that suggest we may not see them as soon as people are hoping.
New U.S. home sales are up 5.9% year over year in February, while existing home sales dropped 3.3%. What does that tell us?
It tells us that builders have a lot more scope and incentive to move inventory through all kinds of perks and, you know, throwing things in to the price, also buying down interest rates. So builders have been buying down the mortgage rates and offering these teaser rates or starter rates where it's below market rates for the first year, second year, third year. But eventually that all comes off the profits of the builders themselves, but it's a way to kind of stimulate demand in new home sales. And we've been seeing that work to a large degree. Now, what interest rates are when these bought down terms come up for renewal remains to be seen. And Whether or not people will have trouble affording their homes at that point is an open question. But at least for, you know, the initial period of ownership, they can see some reduced costs. Whereas existing properties, you know, existing home sales don't have that kind of flexibility. They're basically just asking a price and hoping they get it, right? So, but the issue, of course, is affordability both in Canada and the United States. Now, in 2021, for example, the qualifying income you needed for the median U.S. home was under $58,000. By the fourth quarter of 23, it was $108,000 that the median household needed in order to qualify for the median-priced home. In Canada, it's even worse than that, of course, because our median household income is actually less than that. It's $85,000, and our home prices are that much more expensive. So, you know, to qualify for the maximum home price that the median income can afford in Canada right now is less than $500,000, Jim, and that's assuming you put a 20% down and you have 25-year amortization. But the way that our prices got so obscene during the low-rate era that, you know, the average home price is now just under $800,000, which is about more than nine times the median household income. I've mentioned this before, but it bears repeating. The long-standing affordability rule is home prices shouldn't be more than three to four times your annual household income. So if you're talking about something that's, you know, nine times, and in many of the larger areas where the bulk of the population lives, the average home price is 10 to 12 times the median household income. So it's absolutely unaffordable. And RBC was doing some interesting work that I noted on the blog, where they look at, you know, the change between what the median household could qualify for in terms of maximum purchasing budget in early 21 versus today. And of course, you know, the prices went parabolic, then interest rates tripled, and now we're really paying for that, because although home prices have come off in Canada about 12% nationally from the peak in 2022, the reality is home affordability is today the worst it's been in more than 40 years, because, you know, the average, again, the median household income is, they need to spend about 63% of it just to cover basic shelter costs. And in large centers, as I say, where the bulk of the population lives, like 106% of household income is needed in Vancouver. In other words, it's impossible. They need more income than they have in order to just keep a shelter over their heads. And in the Greater Toronto area, near where I live, it's about 85%. So the only city in Canada that has a ownership costs of anywhere near reasonable or affordable is Edmonton, where it's about 36% share of the household income needed. And again, the long-standing rule of affordability there is 32% of your gross annual income is the maximum that you should go put towards principal, interest, property taxes, et cetera. And the other thing, Jim, of course, is with interest rates, you know, everyone's talking about them being too tight, too high. The reality is that mortgage rates today are more in line with historical norms and medians than they are at any extreme. They're not very high. They're just not obscenely low and artificially suppressed at this point. So the thing that's got to give here is not so much, yes, the Bank of Canada may start cutting rates and, you know, that present expectation is for perhaps 75 basis points in 2024, but that will still not significantly reduce the interest cost for many of these fixed-term mortgages that people are trying to take out, because the price portion is still way too high. And right now we're seeing this flood of listings come on with the spring market across the country, and certainly in the area where I live, it's really evident. They're popping up like measles, I like to say. Lots of signs all across the board. But the reality is, again, that buyers are looking for what they can qualify for in terms of borrowing, and they have a certain budget. And that budget is significantly lower than the sellers are hoping to get. You know, sellers are looking back and thinking they want to get the price they could when mortgage rates were less than 3%. And in fact, that's not a possibility on the current math. Not only that, but commercial properties, of course, are coming up on the radar at a very high clip right now, because the vacancy rate in all across America, the average vacancy rate in places like Toronto for office space and things is like 20%. We've not seen this in many decades, this level of vacancy. And at the same time, commercial mortgage rates are above 9%. So, you know, something's got to give here, and the what has to give is prices, in my view. Prices still have significantly further to fall.
Should younger Canadian adults give up any hope of owning a home?
I think they shouldn't give up hope, but I think they shouldn't get sucked into these bidding wars at multiples that make no sense and that are going to create great misery for them and their families. If you have no affordability for anything else other than the roof over your head, that is an absolute recipe for misery. So I would suggest that they don't get into this obsession about needing to get on the property ladder, and in fact realize that as prices come down, that's in their benefit. And meanwhile, interest rates on the savings that they are building up towards a housing fund, you know, the correct place to keep funds that you're building up for your housing is in savings, high interest savings, or, you know, short-term GICs. And those interest rates today are the highest they've been since 2007. You're making a decent return on, you know, just putting money in there and piling it up. And that patience and discipline, I think, is going to pay off in the long run if they take the time to let prices correct and to build up their savings and wait so that they have the strength to buy when the right price presents at the right multiple of their household income.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, the latest data shows households have a record 48% of their financial assets allocated to equities, the same level as the tech top in March 2000, and then we had the dot-com bubble burst, and above the cycle peaks in early 2008 and 2022. What does that suggest about risk-reward prospects from here?
Well, it's a couple of things. First of all, financial asset value, the percentage of your overall household assets, obviously goes up with price. So when you have equities trading at all-time highs in valuations, that will also be reflected in the size of the asset allocation percentage. So, you know, as you correctly pointed out, we're at 48% today, similar to what we were at the cycle peak more than 2 years ago. Another way of saying that very little progress has been made for 2 years, because basically, you know, assets got to extreme overvaluation in early 21. They crashed into 22, rallied from last October. And then as they've done that, people do this really self-destructive phenomenon where as prices go up, they want to put whatever savings they can add or more money in. And, you know, it's the only thing in the world, Jim, where the things get more expensive, people want more of them. Whereas typically in a consumer good or something like that, as prices come down, you would think people would want to buy them then. But instead, in this scenario, same with housing, frankly, when prices were, you know, at the cycle peaks, people were doing anything and everything to prostrate themselves into these debt slave positions so that they could get on the property ladder. And as prices come off, you tend to see people pull back. So anyway, the point is that those were notoriously high market peaks in 2000. As you correctly pointed out, prices crashed 50% after that and took 15 years to recover, certainly on the tech side, the NASDAQ. And in 2007, we didn't even get back to that level of crazy valuation, crazy allocation, but it was more like 40%. And, you know, prices crashed another 50% after that. And so here we are back there with, you know, as Jeremy Grantham says, you can't get blood out of a stone. The truth of the matter is that the higher the price you pay, the less your long-term prospective returns are. And from here, they are the worst they've been in terms of looking forward over the next several years. The prospective returns for equities are the worst they've been since 2000 and 2020 and 1929 before that. So those should be sort of warning signs to people that now is not the time to be you know, putting every last dollar you have back in the speculative risk trade. And the other feature, which I think is so important to point out, first of all, people have no business putting any money they expect to spend on a house, for example, or a condo, something in the next few years, into the equity market. It's not the correct place to keep that kind of savings. When you have money that you have earmarked for another purpose, it's not long-term investment dollars, so you need to keep it in the most liquid, secure deposits and that sort of thing. So that's the first thing. And I know a lot of people do that wrong, and they pay repeatedly over the course of the cycle. The other thing is that if you're piling all your assets in now and your cash levels are extremely low, and we know that that's the case because we also chart, you know, cash allocations, and we can see that whether it's the individual, Wall Street strategists, or mutual funds themselves, basically there's the lowest level of cash available in any of these accounts, liquid dry powder, you know, available to go into the market, the lowest level we have seen since at least, like, in decades. We haven't, it's even worse than, you know, at the market peaks in 2007. So there's very little cash left available because everyone's been putting in whatever was there at these record valuations. So that also tells you that, as I like to say, once everyone who has bought will buy, everyone who will buy or can buy has bought, all you have left is sellers. And so we know that fund managers, even when they, you know, have no more cash to put to work, many of them will borrow money to increase their leverage, because if they can do that and prices go up further, that magnifies the gain. Of course, the understated impact of that is also that it incredibly magnifies the loss potential. So once people need to take cash, and baby boomers are indeed net cash out people these days. You know, they're between 61 and 76, and they are now withdrawing and drawing down their savings in order to live and pay their bills and all that sort of thing. Well, they are now net redeemers from financial markets. And so the only positive flows, the main driver since 2000, actually, it's really quite incredible to look at these charts, has been corporations buying back their own shares. And without that flow, markets would definitely have not performed or expanded the price and the multiple for equities in any way like it has done. And that has been, you know, this flow of executives at companies going, what should we do with cash? Well, our compensation is primarily driven by the price of the shares. So let's get the share price up. So let's use this cash to buy back the shares, force up the price, and then we'll liquidate our holdings into that flow. That's been going on now for a couple of decades, but with increasing incident because there's been less things to put capital into that look attractive on a risk-reward basis, so they're just doing these financial gimmicks. So all of that has really just magnified the risk in financial markets, as I say, at a time when the bulk of the asset holders are over 50, are already into the sort of later part of their life cycle, which means they have the least risk tolerance they've had since in their life, because their time horizon is not very long anymore. They have to have this workout in real time. So it's a terrible mismatch between this overvalued, extremely levered asset climate versus the risk tolerance and liquidity needed by the individuals. And I think it's a recipe for disaster. And, you know, I just think people should really look at their own scenario and try and figure out, you know, how it would be impacted if the price of the, you know, of their real estate continues to go down over the next couple of years. How would they be impacted if the price of equities continued to contract? Because let's not forget that in every market cycle, when the Fed finally begins the cutting, it's in response to negative data in the economy and a rising unemployment rate, and this typically cascades into more people losing their jobs and more people needing to sell assets, more people needing cash, and that is when the bulk of the equity losses happen. So if, you know, we haven't even got to the cutting phase here yet, so we really can't talk about, you know, how well things have gone until we get into that period and we let the gravity really spread through the economy from the hikes that have happened, and we'll see then what the downside risk here is. So, you know, the good news is we're getting really close to that, and, you know, they could be cutting rates by sometime by the third quarter of 24, and once they start cutting, they typically cut for several quarters, several, you know, over a period of perhaps a year. And it's during that time that we're going to get to see just where the bodies are buried here. So we're not far from it, but I think that people really should be aware of the risks and look at their financial scenario to make sure that they can thrive through it and have some liquidity on the other side.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at House Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.